The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Werke, Judge Eid, the Honorable Louise Dovray Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, November 16th, although it feels outside like it's September 16th, and we're not complaining. We are here for oral argument in three matters today. The first case is State of Minnesota versus Ronald Schober. I'll just remind you, counsel, that you each get 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument because it is being recorded. And lastly, the podium can be raised and lowered with a button that's right under the center of it. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Christina Zahar, and I represent appellant Ronald Lee Schober. In this case, the district court erred in denying appellant's pre-sentence motion to withdraw his guilty plea, wherein he had agreed to a life sentence in prison due to the ineffective assistance of his then counsel. In this case, the state sought a life sentence for appellant after indicting him for third-degree criminal sexual conduct under the repeat offender sentencing provisions of Minnesota Statute 609.3455. After a jury was impaneled and trial was about to begin is when appellant entered into a plea agreement that included a life sentence in prison. There was a mandatory minimum term of 41 months. Following that plea agreement, but prior to sentencing, appellant discharged his counsel, hired new counsel, and immediately filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. That is when the district court denied that motion, sentenced him to life in prison in accordance with the plea agreement.
Just so I'm reminded of the record, in connection with the motion to withdraw the plea, your client didn't submit an affidavit describing any of the proceedings or any of his interaction with his lawyer in connection with the plea itself?
So the affidavit from the appellant was submitted as attached to his motion to discharge his counsel, and that is what we cite to for that information. It wasn't an affidavit attached to that motion.
Doesn't your burden of proof require that you show how your client would have acted differently had he been aware of this? I mean, he obviously recited that he knew he had a lifetime conditional release, that he had to register as a predatory offender, the SOR requirements. Don't you have that burden? And if you agree, how did you demonstrate that?
I agree that we do have that burden to establish that. And what shows that he would have acted differently pertains mostly to the decision of whether to go to trial or not. That is what he would have done differently, but for his ineffective assistance of counsel. And he throughout this case, throughout the entire timeline of the case, was prepared to proceed to trial. That was the plan. And it wasn't until after the jury was impaneled that this guilty plea to the life sentence was entered. Since he withdrew his guilty plea or sought to withdraw it before sentencing, that indicates he knew the only reasonable alternative was a trial at that point. If the motion to withdraw would have been granted, it would have proceeded to trial. So he knew that that would have been the alternative for him, and he would have chosen to go to trial but for his ineffective.
That's always the alternative. You go to trial or you don't go to trial. So I don't know if that meets your burden. I mean, doesn't he have to show something differently, if nothing else, to proffer some defense or something to show that he would have acted differently, some evidence nugget that he'd discovered?
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes these pleas are attempted to be withdrawn post-sentencing. And that is a really important factor that the statutes and case law bring up, is whether the motion is made prior to sentencing or after sentencing. If they're made after sentencing, it could be more of a buyer's remorse type of situation once they are actually sentenced, or perhaps a dispute with the sentence they were actually given as a result of a plea agreement, as some plea agreements leave discretion to a court, to a district court, to decide what to sentence a person to. So that's a really important difference here, and a difference according to the law is the timing of the motion to withdraw the plea.
But isn't the problem for you the many statements he made during the actual plea colloquy itself that indicated that he wasn't under any sort of duress, that he was satisfied with his attorney's performance, and that it was his decision without hesitation, no waffling, to go forward with the plea?
That is included in the plea transcript, but also included in the plea transcript is him stating, his fresh collection of concepts that the district court is providing him. So that is also contained in that transcript where the district court is telling him, seemingly for the first time, about conditions of his sentence that he should have known when entering into the plea.
But didn't the court then follow up, and maybe the state as well, do you have any questions about this and you still want to go forward? And didn't he, in fact, enter his guilty plea after all that supplemental information was provided?
He did. He did, Judge. And many of those questions were also very leading at that point. I believe the record as a whole would indicate that a person in that situation with that type of concern or pressure due to the ineffective assistance of counsel would feel very cornered and not sure what to do but proceed with the guilty plea and the plea agreement that was arranged upon. And I think it's also important to point out with this line of questions from the court that defendant did not receive a majority of the discovery from his attorney until after the guilty plea was entered. And so he was in no position to know what he didn't know, in other words, at the time of the plea. According to his affidavit, he had a few pages of discovery prior to that guilty plea, and after the guilty plea is when he received multiple flash drives and other documentation containing the remainder of the discovery that really indicated to him the lack of preparation that his trial counsel had, the lack of pursuing any defenses that were presented in the evidence as well.
But I thought that the reason why he pled guilty, if I understand your theory, is because his attorney was not prepared, right? So he was there, he was at trial, it was mid-trial that he said, I want to enter a guilty plea. And am I understanding your theory right, that the only reason why he did that is because he became aware that his attorney was totally unprepared?
That's correct. And I think that is correct, but also I would say that resolve was strengthened upon the further information that he received following the guilty plea.
But you agree there's nothing in the record when he's questioned at the time of the guilty plea indicating that the only reason why I'm doing this is because my attorney's unprepared and I think I'm going to lose.
That's correct. He did not say that. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes with these ineffective assistance of counsel cases, we look at what's not on the record to show the ineffective assistance of counsel because it isn't always clear due to the nature itself of what it means for counsel to be ineffective. It's not always clear on the record what this counsel did or did not do. And this case is full of examples of a lack of due diligence and a lack of basic standards that his attorney failed to follow, especially in preparing for such a serious case. Not only was this a felony criminal sexual conduct case, but a case where the client was facing a life sentence in prison. That's a very important factor, too.
And this plea agreement that he took, I mean, minimize that, right? I mean, there was an agreement by the state to seek the 41-month mandatory minimum rather than life imprisonment. I mean, there was benefit to this settlement agreement to your client, was there not?
Well, the statute always requires that mandatory, a number of months to be that mandatory minimum.
But the state was going to ask for more, wasn't it? I mean, weren't they asking for 57? And so plea agreement was something that benefited your client.
Correct. So that is the benefit that would have been received is whether that first chance to request parole occurred at 41 months or 57 months. That is absolutely correct.
Well, here's what I think really undercuts your argument. I mean, I'm going to be very blunt with you. You know, if we look at the documents and we look at the PSI, and the PSI is asked, why did you plead guilty? And he goes on and on about how he wanted to, I'm just paraphrasing his comments, but something about saving the victims from being re-victimized. And he went on to talk about how time off work, they had to come into court, and that was the reason he'd pled guilty. Doesn't that severely undercut what you're trying to say, that he did this because of this enormous perceived pressure to make a decision and move on with the jury trial or elect to plead?
How I would respond to that is when a person is participating in a PSI, especially a person experienced with the legal system, they would know the appropriate way to answer questions to get the best benefit out of a plea agreement or sentence that they were given. That does undercut the argument. I don't know if I would say it severely undercuts the argument, because again, we're talking about a person who is in a situation where they are facing a life sentence, and they're under the pressure of that life sentence, and they're making decisions or presenting themselves accordingly, either when they're in front of the judge or when they are participating in that PSI with probation. Almost simultaneously to that same time is when he filed that motion to discharge his trial counsel and laid out in a very lengthy pro se document his issues with his trial counsel for the district court judge. So I think there is a really important distinction about how a person presents themselves during the plea or during the PSI versus what he presented, again, almost simultaneous in time with his own motions expressing his concern with what was happening with his trial counsel.
Obviously, under the Strickland analysis, our last one of our determinations is the prejudice that would result, and the state has in their briefing has indicated the significant prejudice that they assert would befall them should this plea allow to be withdrawn. I mean, what's your strongest argument to contradict the fact that passage of time, witnesses, everybody was ready to go to trial, and to go back now is as the state claims, prejudicial?
That's correct, Judge, and that would be the standard under the fair and just standard for the court to withdraw the guilty plea, the second of the two. And it is correct that the state has indicated that they have that prejudice. I'm not disputing that the state is prejudiced. They're probably almost always prejudiced if a plea is withdrawn and they were prepared to proceed to trial. In this case, that concern for the state's prejudice is outweighed by the defendant's constitutional rights and his right to have effective assistance of counsel in a case, especially where his life is on the line and we're talking about a life sentence. It's critical that that person have adequate representation to protect them in these legal proceedings and to at least do due diligence and bare minimum aspects of criminal legal representation to make sure that person is making informed decisions about whether to proceed to trial or whether to plead guilty and, in this case, accept a life sentence.
You agree that it's your burden to rebut the state's showing of prejudice to its case, right? And you don't really address that at all in your opening brief, the prejudice to the state.
That's correct. We don't address it much in the opening brief. We address it more in the reply brief.
As I understood it, your point in the reply was to focus on lack of evidence in the record showing that the victim would be unable to appropriately recall events or mm-hmm. that the state's case would be prejudiced with regard to the victim. The district court did make some alternative findings or at least conclusions in its order about not only the victim but also the other 14 witnesses. What is your response to that and the evidence in the record supporting prejudice in favor of the state?
Thank you. And Judge, we're again talking about the fair and just standard, which is an abuse of discretion we're looking at for the district court. And our position would be that that is another example of how the district court did abuse his discretion here. No hearing was held on this motion to withdraw the guilty plea. So the state did not present any testimony or evidence supporting these statements of the type of prejudice they would receive or the number of witnesses that were ready, et cetera, that is not supported by facts or evidence that were actually presented on the record, as there was no hearing held. And so
there was 14 witnesses on a witness list that the state had filed prior to trial, right?
On a witness list, yes.
And the fact that the case was continued because of the fall that the victim had had for a number of months, and the fact that the victim was developmentally delayed, that was part and parcel to the charges too, right?
Not a fall or accident, I suppose, fall, but the mental impairment, correct. That was part of the charge.
All right. It seems like the court's findings are somewhat based on the nature of the record, the entire record before the court, right?
They are somewhat. But the court's findings also found that the record was crystal clear regarding the validity of the plea, and that is just not the case here. And so not only are we rebutting the state's The state has the burden to present that they were prejudiced by this. We have the burden to present why the defendant wanted to withdraw his guilty plea, and it is those burdens that the district court is to weigh against each other when making this decision.
So, Ms. Zoller, when the jury is impaneled, you got everybody there at the courthouse, and the judge is examining your client as to whether or not he's understanding the totality of what he's doing, you know, again, I keep harboring on his own remarks that I think kind of sinks him, and the judge says, look, you know, I'm hesitant, I'm not going to let the jury go, it's a big deal, we get all these people in here, and your client asserts, there's no waffling. And to me, that's a very dramatic statement. There's no waffling. I'm going to go ahead with this plea. I mean, you look at those factors. Does that, I mean, you certainly must agree that cuts against the fact that he claims he was under duress or confusion. That's a very affirmative, aggressive statement, not just like, yeah, I guess we'll go ahead. I'm not going to change my mind. No waffling.
Thank you, Judge. May I answer? I am out of time. I would say no waffling, according to the case law, is actually fairly common. And what we look to, according to Ellis Strong and the Rhodes cases that are cited, is actually the nature of the questions that were asked, whether the defendant was asked leading questions, which the district court actually acknowledged in their order in this case, that the plea hearing was very leading. And so it is common, according to the case law, that I haven't seen any case law, at least, that talks about waffling or confidence in how a guilty plea is given, but instead in the way the questions are asked and how we ultimately land with that guilty plea. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Angela Erickson, and I am here representing respondent, the state of Minnesota. Your Honors, in this case, an extremely lengthy record was made at the trial hearing and the plea hearing with the appellant under oath, not only about his understanding of his rights, but his satisfaction with his attorney's performance. Conditional release was correctly reviewed with appellant on the record. Predatory offender was correctly reviewed with appellant on the record. He was given the opportunity to ask further questions or take further time, not only with his attorney, but with the state and the judge, and appellant repeatedly stated that he understood all of his rights, that he understood the issues that we're here on appeal discussing today, and he did not have any further questions or need further time. The court statements in Kaiser that public policy favors the finality of judgments and courts are not disposed to encourage accused persons to play games with the court by setting aside judgments of conviction based on pleas made with deliberation and accepted by the court with caution is particularly relevant in this case. If this court allows withdrawal of the guilty plea on these facts based solely on appellant's later self-serving claims that he did not understand, the state is hard-pressed to think of a record that could possibly be made that would be sufficient to withstand appellate review.
Well, since you're referring to the record, what do you make of the points that the appellant makes in the reply brief about returning this for an evidentiary hearing to further expand on the deficient performance prong?
The reality, Your Honor, is that appellant has the burden of proof in this matter. The appellant had an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. There was a in-chambers conference in this matter that was held on November 4th, wherein the purpose of that hearing was to set an evidentiary hearing. Appellant's counsel waived that and chose to submit the record solely on the transcripts and written argument. So the appellant has now waived the opportunity to have that evidentiary hearing because they did not wish to have one.
Was that waiver of the evidentiary hearing, did that go on the record or is that on the docket somewhere?
Your Honor, it's on the minute sheet of submitting it via written argument and the record.
Okay. And that was for the motion to withdraw the plea?
That's correct.
All right. And what about the argument that your counterpart has made that some of the responses regarding satisfaction with counsel and wanting to proceed were in response to leading questions. This is a little different than the briefed argument about the factual basis being in response to leading questions. What do you have to say about the argument that we can't rely on what the appellant said at the plea hearing because he was being led by the judge or by the prosecutor?
Your Honor, I don't know how the district court could possibly ask, are you satisfied with your attorney's performance in any other way? I've never experienced a plea hearing where they ask, state in your own words the ways that you're satisfied with your attorney's performance.
Sure, it was a little more leading than that. The questions were, you are satisfied with your attorney's performance, aren't you? And so I take your point. Sometimes the distinction is a little fine between do you have any concerns about your attorney's performance and are you satisfied with your attorney's performance, but did you have any other response to the idea that the appellant was led at that hearing to agree that he was satisfied and that he was prepared to enter the plea?
Your Honor, I do feel like it was reviewed a number of times, particularly at the jury trial date. Appellant was asked, is there anything that we should know about your attorney's performance here? And appellant stated there was not.
But that was before he decided to plead guilty, right?
Correct.
That was the day, and he was considering taking the plea, and the next day is when he came back and decided to accept it. Is that right?
That's correct. However, if he was concerned about his attorney's performance, as appellant alleges, that he was not prepared for trial, that would have been apparent at that time. He was also asked at the plea hearing, do you feel he's done a good job for you? Do you feel he's been responsive when you've asked him questions? Do you feel he's been responsive when you've said, I don't understand something or I don't understand the consequences? A number of questions were asked of him regarding his attorney's performance rather than just simply a leading question in that regard. I do want to address as well the questions that were asked about the benefits to appellant of this plea agreement. I think it's important to note that the mandatory minimum term that was agreed to in this case was the bottom of the box for the sentencing guidelines. The 57 months was the top of the box. However, that was not what the state was limited to. The state did have an upward departure motion in this case as well and had intended, if this matter proceeded to trial and a verdict of guilty was reached, to ask for a significantly increased amount of mandatory minimum time. So there was a significant benefit to appellant.
When we review this under the fair and just standard, do you have any comment on whether we consider comments that were in a PSI about how he was going to go to trial but changed his mind because he didn't want to put the victim and everyone at difficulty in having to come back? Is that something that we can fairly look at?
Your Honor, it is part of the record, and I do think that the court can consider those comments. I think that the comments made by appellant prior to making the self-serving decision to withdraw a guilty plea are particularly relevant to his thought process at the time. With regards to the factual basis, I did want to touch on that. Appellant argues that an insufficient factual basis was laid because appellant maintained that he did not know that the victim was mentally impaired. However, the statute does not require that appellant know that the victim was mentally impaired if they have reason to know. An appellant specifically stated that he knew that this victim lived in a group home, knew that she wore a helmet, and specifically stated that he had reason to know that she was mentally impaired and that because of her impaired intelligence, she lacked the judgment to give reasoned consent. So in this case, there was a sufficient factual basis laid to each and every element of the offense.
Even if I agree with you that the record would support that sort of a conclusion, I mean, doesn't the fact that the appellant had difficulty acknowledging the factual basis of the plea and otherwise had to be led along, doesn't that reflect in fact the ineffectiveness that he's claiming and that the record contains evidence of in the form of his affidavit?
I don't think so, Your Honor. in my experience, it's frequently difficult, particularly in these type of cases of criminal sexual conduct cases, for appellant to admit on the record the acts that he's committed. His statements in the PSI support his factual basis as well and his reasoning for why he committed this offense in the first place. While I understand that the questions regarding factual basis were leading, the case law doesn't hold that leading questions are not allowable or that they will automatically invalidate a plea. And in fact, in the case cited by appellant, leading questions were utilized, and not only were leading questions utilized, but one of the elements, premeditation, was not addressed on the record, and the court still upheld that conviction. A number of the claims made in appellant's brief were not supported by the record. The statements regarding witnesses and review of discovery are completely contradictory to his sworn statements on the record at the plea hearing. And his statements regarding that witnesses were not spoken to prior to trial, or that counsel failed to advise appellant of a jury determination being necessary on aggravating factors, that is contained nowhere in the record other than appellant's argument. It is not contained in appellant's affidavit to the court prior to this. It is not contained in his statements on the record, either at the trial hearing or the plea hearing. This court cannot rely on appellant's arguments as evidence to decide this case.
To be fair, he did. I think the appellant's point is that he was pretty specific about thinking that the conditional release period was going to be 10 years, and that seems like it must have come from somewhere, and that's somewhat analogous to Ellis Strong. I understand that the transcript goes on to disabuse him of that mistaken belief, but I think his point is that is evidence that information came from his attorney. What's your response to that?
I don't believe that was a strong statement. I can't remember the exact words that Your Honor used, but his statement was, I thought it was possibly a 10-year. And again, there is no evidence on the record as to where that belief came from. And we can't look into evidence that does not exist on the record. The reality is that nowhere does he ever state, including in his affidavit, which I think is particularly relevant, that his attorney misadvised him on the length of conditional release. Even if his attorney, for argument's sake, mistakenly advised him of a 10-year conditional release period when it was life, I think the fact that this was reviewed with him in length on the record, not only the length of that conditional release, but also what the terms and what that conditional release would look like. He was offered an opportunity to ask any additional questions, and he was asked, knowing this information now, do you still wish to go forward with your plea, is evidence that it was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. With regards to I do want to touch on, under the fair and just standard, the prejudice. Appellant argues in the rebuttal brief that there is no evidence contained on the record regarding that. However, there is evidence contained of the significant prejudice to the state based on the fact that by the time this court decides this matter, it will be nearly 3 years after this offense occurred. There were 14 witnesses assembled, prepared, subpoenaed for trial in this matter that would need to be located and reassembled. Additionally, the court did make a number of statements on the record, not only in its order, but also on the record at the October 3rd and October 12th hearing regarding the stress and anguish that the victims have suffered and continue to suffer due to the lack of finality in this matter.
Can we rely on that without, as counsel argued, a hearing and specific testimony or evidence, since it is your burden to show prejudice under the fair and just standard as applied to the plea withdrawal?
Your Honor, I think that the court can rely on statements made on the record by the district court, given that the district court was in the best position to see the victim's family, see the victim in court, and make those determinations. Your Honor, the state also does not believe that appellant has met its burden in proving that the appellant would not have pled guilty but for the alleged inefficiencies of his counsel. In addition to the district court's findings about the benefit of this plea to appellant, if you look at the motion to withdraw, to discharge his attorney, he is not clear at all that that is what he wishes to do with regards to withdrawing his guilty plea, that he would wish to go back to trial at that time, which was subsequent to his plea being held. So I think that's evidence that he, but for these deficiencies, alleged deficiencies, that he would not have pled guilty. If there are no further questions by the court, the state is asking that this court affirm the district's court's decision and allow this plea to stand. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sahar, you will have the last word.
Thank you. When a defendant is entering a guilty plea, they have to answer the questions yes, or else the guilty plea will not go through. If a defendant says, no, I'm not sure I want to do this, no, I don't think my counsel has been adequate for me, the guilty plea will not go through. So any case that we're looking at a question of withdrawing a guilty plea, a defendant would have answered yes to the supplementary questions involved in a guilty plea. And this is why we need to look to the rest of the case for clues that counsel was ineffective. We look at the case as a whole and the context of the representation throughout the case.
Can I ask you a question looking at the case as a whole? I was reviewing that the appellant submitted in support of the motion to discharge counsel. Can you direct me, is there a place in the affidavit or in the motion where the appellant says the only reason why I pled guilty or something to that effect is because my attorney was not prepared for trial and I basically performed efficiently?
No, that is not in that affidavit.
So how are we to know for your prejudice argument that the reason why he pled guilty was because he learned of his attorney's lack of preparation?
We find that from the timeline of the case and when his request to withdraw the guilty plea was made, quickly following his discharge of counsel, and then the basis for that withdrawal of the guilty plea.
Evidence in the record, though, that one of the he wanted at that time he wanted his attorney to make a stronger argument against sentencing enhancement and aggravated sentencing he was facing, and that the breakdown was not as much related to the lack of trial preparation, but the reluctance of his attorney to make certain arguments on his behalf at sentencing.
I think the court is referring to like the Blakely enhancements in this case, such as the zone of privacy. And what's really important on that point is that during the plea hearing, there is no Blakely waiver regarding that enhancement factor that's required for the life sentence. And so it appears his counsel, either forgot to mention it or didn't realize that was a required element of this guilty plea, that the client, the defendant, actually needs to agree to those Blakely factors as well, because those are factors for a jury to consider if the case were to proceed to trial. So with absent a Blakely waiver on the record, we have no indication that that was discussed appropriately between the attorney and the defendant.
Do you agree with what counsel argued, that you or the appellant waived the evidentiary hearing below regarding the plea withdrawal motion when offered?
I don't know if that is on the record. I know what the state means by the minute sheet that was referred to, and I believe what the minute sheet indicates is that the motion would proceed with a briefing schedule. I don't think the minute sheet actually, expressly waives that hearing, but I would need to look at that document to be completely sure.
But it's not your recollection that the appellant asked for an evidentiary hearing and was denied an evidentiary hearing?
No, that is also not my recollection.
Okay.
Correct.
It's fair to say. This is not a case where the record is full of indication that defense counsel was functioning well for his client. I think this would be a very different appeal if that was on the record, where we see, you know, thorough motions being filed in responses to the state's Spriegel motion, for example, witness and exhibit list, just really standard filings. Even an indication that defense counsel reviewed the discovery, which is on the record, trial counsel, or the district court actually admonished trial counsel for not reviewing the discovery in this case and continuing to ask for continuances. And so we have those clues and the lack of filings throughout this entire record that do support appellant's position that his trial counsel was ineffective. We don't see what we normally would see in a serious case of this nature for what a defense attorney would do to defend a client in this case. And so not just are we looking at the plea hearing itself, but we need to look at the entirety of the proceedings for information indicating that trial counsel was ineffective, and there's plenty of that on the record, and very tellingly, there's plenty that's not on the record that you would expect to be there for an effective defense counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel. The matter was well presented. We appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.